Dance Your Heart on Fire podcast episode number 71.
Yeah, so there are a couple things that I think are persistent cultural myths, and I hope that they kind of, you know, go away as time goes on and as we continue to have this conversation as a culture. So I just want to run through a couple of them really quickly. So the first one is consent is not something that is only given by women to men. That is such a persistent myth, and I understand why this conversation about consent has been framed around you know, heterosexual couples and women being the ones who have to give consent for sexual activity to men.
That's the night as I remember, and that's the one I wanted, yeah. Just put me close, don't ask me nicely. No excuse, I want it all. I just wanna hear from you. Ask me questions. Oh, I just wanna hear from you.
Welcome to the Dance Your Heart on Fire podcast, the podcast dedicated to inspiring dancers worldwide whose hearts have been touched by music and dance. The universal language of dance and music is spoken by many of us throughout the world. We want to motivate the dancer in you by sharing stories, insights, and ideas to enhance your journey. Join us now with your host, Charles Ogar.
Hello, and welcome to this episode on Consent Basics for Dancers. I wanted to give a little bit of context about this episode before we jumped in. The first thing I wanted to let you know is that this podcast was recorded back in February of 2019 with my friend Caitlin, who lives in Toronto, Ontario. And it's been one of those podcasts that just kind of been sitting on my laptop collecting dust. And in this time of quarantine, I figured it'd be a good time to dust it off and put it out to the public. There are some really nice tips and things that we discussed in this episode. So yes, this is a previous episode from February 2019, and I hope you guys enjoyed. Hello, hello, everyone. This is Charles with the Dance Your Heart on Fire podcast, coming at you with another episode. And my special guest today is a returning guest from Toronto. Her name is Caitlin Ferguson. And if you've been following the podcast for a while, we did do a podcast on consent in the dance scene. I don't remember the podcast number really quickly off the top of my head, but we had a nice conversation about gender roles in the dance scene and how that was changing in our environment. I believe that was back in, was that 2016?
It was almost exactly 2 years ago, February of 2017. I had to look it up.
So we talked about the possibility of a second podcast, and now we kind of like cross paths again. And for this podcast, we're going to be focusing on consent in the dance world and how that means for students and social dancers to teachers and performers to event organizers, because there's definitely been some shifts concerning the consent world, even back in 2016 when we first had the podcast, and even getting into today's world, and more events are speaking of consent. So I think this podcast would be really, really helpful for the listeners to kind of see the importance of it, the conversation of it, and how that can kind of help change our culture for the dance scene in general. Let's talk about the Me Too movement. I think that'd be a good place to start, because that kind of like started back in 2016. What have you noticed with the Me Too movement in regards to our dance scene as a whole? And we do talk about the dance scene. This is not just Kizomba. We're talking about Salsa Bachata, Kizomba, Zouk, West Coast Swing, all of the above.
Yeah. So the Me Too movement kind of burst onto the scene not long after we recorded our last podcast. So I believe it was the fall of 2017, mm-hmm. where it really became a cultural force. And so mostly, I mean, I've just heard a lot of chatter, a lot of people sharing their stories, unfortunately, about being assaulted or having their boundaries crossed in a way that was unacceptable. So you just see a lot more open conversation about it. You know, speaking as a woman, women have always talked about this stuff in our private spaces. And since I started dance when I was 19 years old, we've always kind of taken the time to warn each other about leaders who were problematic, or just people who are problematic, mm-hmm. and who you should be careful around. But now that's really happening more out in the open. So it's more visible to men. And so it's really started a conversation culturally. And dance is not immune from that. In Zouk especially, there have been a few kind of high profile people who have been the subject of complaints, public complaints. And so we're kind of having to deal with that as a scene right now.
As one thing that you notice as well with this high profile performers, and not just for Zouk, but like across multiple dances, I remember talking about this concept of consent with one of my friends who is a massage therapist. And mm-hmm. she talked about having to like go through an ethics course, because obviously massage therapy involves touching another person. And of course, if you're a male massage therapist or a female massage therapist, like, of course, there has to be ethics involved in having a stranger and them removing articles of clothing and being in like one-on-one environment. Like, they have to take an ethics code and they have to get licensed to kind of be able to offer that service publicly. So it's regulated, you know, but for dance, it is not regulated. And I guess we're kind of seeing some of the ramifications of that, because I mean, anybody can become an instructor. There's no licensing, there's no certification that kind of gives people like this accreditation to be an instructor, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know if I mentioned this in my last podcast, but in my professional life, I work as the member services and education administrator for the Registered Massage Therapists Association of Ontario. Mm-hmm. So all day, every day, I educate massage therapists and help them with the regulations that they have to follow in order to continue in their profession. And yeah, for any profession, especially any health profession where you are required to touch a person as part of their, as part of your job, you have to take a number of courses as part of your schooling about ethics and about informed consent, which is different from just consent. And there are a whole bunch of regulations that you have to follow. And the informed consent process continues throughout the entire life of your therapeutic relationship with your patients. So that's something that I deal with every day. And it's always a hot topic with massage therapists. It's something that we talk about a lot.
Definitely. And I think it's really, really important to just be able to, for the general public, to use that massage therapist and feel safe about it, you know? But of course, we're talking about licensed professionals and offering a service mm-hmm. and exchange of money. But social dancing, it's kind of like just people having fun and touching each other that way. And this is also like social dance is sometimes a really cultural thing. People grow up dancing and touching one another, whether they're cumbia dancing, salsa dancing, kizomba dancing, wherever they have you. Sometimes it's just like instilled. You're like doing it with family members and things like that. And then we have like the other studio side of things where people are taking class with other strangers and there's touch involved. And then we're talking about also dance events where a larger gathering of strangers or friends are getting together and also touching each other in different ways, you know? So it's very interesting to see all of these different perspectives in regards to touch and making sure just people are consenting to be in touch, or maybe they're like, it's just kind of like an implied consent because you're an attendee at the event, you know?
Yeah. So for, you know, for health professionals, you go to school, you pass an entry to practice exam, and then you have certain requirements that you have to satisfy to keep your license for the life of your career. But for a dance teacher, I mean, really the only requirements to become a dance teacher are talent and some charisma, so that people actually want to come out to your classes and learn from you. There is no ethics course. There is no license. There's no regulation really whatsoever. So as a scene, we kind of have to self-police and figure out as a scene what we're going to do about people who behave in a way that's not acceptable, because I don't really see it happening where dance becomes something that's regulated by law. That seems unlikely. I don't think a lot of people would want that, and the bureaucracy that comes with it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, teachers and organizers have to figure out a way to handle this and present a united front on this so that everybody feels safe, and so that you socialize people appropriately when they're coming into the scene, so that new dancers learn right away what is expected of them in terms of seeking consent, giving consent. Yeah, how you're expected to behave with other dancers.
For sure, definitely. And you have some text here about, you see a lot of teachers a lot across many dances or dance scenes that are emphasizing how consent is involved in every second of a social dance. And this idea of how a move is suggested and the follower is then choosing to execute that lead on how she wants to execute the lead or avoid it altogether.
Yeah. So that's something I've actually seen change as I kind of moved through my career as a social dancer. So I started social dance probably 8 years ago. And in that time, I've moved through salsa into Zouk. And now I also do Argentine tango as well. And my Argentine tango teachers were actually the first ones who kind of put it in this way, where every step in the dance there's never a command, it's a conversation. So every step is suggested and the follow has a choice, whether they want to accept the suggestion and go along with it, whether they want to suggest something else or just flat out refuse to do it. So they would kind of do this exercise in class where the leader would lead her and he would say something, he would be joking and say something like, oh, do you want to go get ice cream right now? And then she would follow his move and say, yes, I would. And then he would say, okay, well, what flavor would you like? And she would follow the move and say, oh, I would like chocolate. And it was this cute little thing that they did to just kind of show how tango is a conversation. It's not a series of commands that you're giving and your follow just follows them without question. So that was kind of revolutionary for me to see that. I thought it was a really nice way of demonstrating respect for the follower. And now I'm starting to see that a lot in Zouk as well. A lot of teachers are showing that a lead is never a command to the follower. And a lot of teachers are doing a great job of showing the followers what options you have if you don't feel safe following a move, because Zouk is quite an athletic dance. So sometimes, you know, you're not into what is being suggested. And so they're doing a really good job of showing ways that you can suggest something else or follow in a safe way for you without having to flat out refuse if you also don't really want to refuse. So just promoting that idea of the conversation between the lead and follow at all times.
For sure. Definitely important things to consider. And I feel like it definitely enhances the dance when you look at it more like a conversation. Even in the previous podcast, we were talking about how gender roles are now starting to become a little bit more fluid, as they are also in everyday society. You're starting to see more non-gendered restrooms, for example. And I believe I heard not too long ago in the official Jack and Jill Brazilian Zouk Council, it's also becoming degendered now. Yeah,
it has. Yes. So that was really exciting because in Zouk, it's kind of exploded recently, but like a lot of people want to lead and follow. And so having competitions degendered is a big deal for a lot of people. People are really excited about it. The way it's been done, I think it could have a little bit more flexibility. It's not perfect yet, but it's a huge step forward. And so when we have our Canada Zoot Congress here in May, that's going to be the first competition I'm attending where it's degendered. So I'm super excited to see how that turns out. And just with social dancing.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to be there. I don't know if I told you or if you've heard.
I did. Yes, I heard. That's really exciting.
So that'll be my first primarily Zouk, but I want to kind of take the newcomer program to kind of see how that's offered to students, but then also just kind of seeing how that whole culture is. And Laura is awesome. And
yes, she is.
I want to come out and support her event. So I'll be there in Toronto in May. If any of you guys are listening there and want to check out the event, we'll put the link in the show notes.
Yes, I believe we have a couple of newcomer tickets and 22 leader tickets left last time I looked. So we're getting down to it. Nice. But we are super excited to have you.
Taking this conversation along. So, I mean, if we just take humans and put them interacting with one another over the centuries, obviously there can be attraction, there can be flirtation, it can be consensual sexual relationship, whatever you can. Yeah. That's been happening for centuries and centuries. So it's not something that's foreign or wrong or anything like that. I think the main thing is just to make sure that all parties feel respected and feel safe and no one is taking advantage of one another, you know? And I think sometimes in the social dancing, it's important to kind of be able to distinguish where are those boundaries and when do they get crossed and when do you cross that boundary with both parties, on board to cross that boundary versus like one person dragging another or crossing the boundaries without, expressed consent. So, that offers a different liability to social dancing as a student or a social dancer, as a teacher, and then also as an event organizer. And I think that's kind of where we are right now. It's like, what are these boundaries and how do we manage them and recognize them and then, I guess, cross them or respect them accordingly, depending on each interaction, you know?
Yeah, so I think as social dancers, we're in a really interesting position in North American culture because we almost have more of a chance to practice good consent than people who are not dancers because we're in this position where, as part of our social life, we're constantly touching other people, handling their body in this culture that is extremely touch averse, you know? So, and a lot of social dance scenes, you know, they're very huggy as well. So like you're hugging people to say hello, then you're dancing with them and working with their body to do things that you can't do as a solo dancer, and, you know, to make these moves happen. So it's really amazing, but you have a chance to practice respecting somebody's body far more often than you would if you were just a non-dancer and you never touch anybody except for like your partner and your close friends, maybe. So I think we're in a really unique position where through dance class and social dance experience, you can also learn a lot about good consent in your private life.
Definitely.
So we can kind of go through it and we can talk about this means if you are a student or a social dancer versus if you're a teacher or an event organizer and what is expected of you depending on the role that you play in your community.
For sure, for sure. You have some bullet points here and we can definitely go down those and offer our listeners some insight into this.
Yeah. So I really, you know, I want to keep this positive and just kind of like a primer on what good consent looks like. I don't want anybody to feel like they're being attacked or like I'm pointing fingers at anyone. So just if you're curious about consent and what it actually means, I'm just trying to give you a little guide here for what that looks like. And obviously I can't cover everything. This is a huge topic, but this is just the basics. So let's start with students and social dancers, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. So the most obvious point I want to make is that no means no. And this goes for on and off the dance floor. If you hear it, stop what you're doing right away. There's no, are you sure, or trying to convince somebody that they're wrong to say no. Just stop and ask what the problem is and go from there. I think that not only does no mean no, but we're kind of having this moment in North America where we're renegotiating what consent looks like. So we're moving from just no means no to only yes means yes. Mm-hmm. In dance, this can be a little bit tougher. Basically, you know, if you're leading, regardless of your gender, you need to be paying close attention to your follower and looking at their comfort level during the dance. And if they are consistently, you know, refusing a move or avoiding close hold or just seeming uncomfortable, you know, it's okay to talk to them, to stop the dance and talk to them and ask, you know, are you okay? Is something making you uncomfortable? Do you not like this move that I'm trying to do? And have an actual conversation. But otherwise, during a dance, you're relying a lot on implicit and implied consent, and just, you know, as long as your partner keeps following everything you're suggesting and they don't appear to be distressed in any way, then you're good to go.
For sure. And I would say, I know sometimes I've talked to some of my guy friends and they mm-hmm. feel like sometimes they hear no's, but there's like different meanings behind those no's, you know? And you know, like the way we have this culture or this idea of like, oh, she's playing hard to get. And so she's mm-hmm. saying no, but she's not meaning no. And so that gets a little bit dicey. But I would definitely implore my friends, if she's saying no or she's hesitant or anything like that, like you don't have to. It's better to just be safe and not push the agenda or the subject or the move or the invitation or what have you, you know, because I don't know, just talking to some of my guy friends, they're like, oh, well, she said no, but she kind of hesitated or she smiled or something like that. So it's just better to just keep it safe and just keep your distance and like wait for like explicit verbal consent. And then sometimes it's like not even verbal, you know, it's like this reminds me of like talking to some of my girlfriends. And it's like we have this culture of like, oh, the guy is the one that should always make the first move or go in for the first kiss and all that kind of stuff. So it's like this taking of a risk to like cross that boundary and hoping he's reading the signs right. And that it gets a little confusing sometimes. But I think that whole, we're going to talk about it later, but like deconstructing that it is okay for women to express sexual interest and not be afraid of like slut shaming or anything like that, because obviously men and women have been having sex for centuries and centuries and centuries, but then women feel like they have to hide that they're sexually interested in anyone. Sometimes they feel like they're it's wrong for them to express it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, if you're hearing a no, it's always the safest option to just assume that no means no.
Play it safe.
And just back off. Mm-hmm. Yeah, play it safe. Absolutely. Yeah, we will definitely get into talking about cultural conditioning and gender roles in terms of sex later on, because I think that's something else that is changing rapidly at the same time as the Me Too movement is happening. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a ton of messaging in our culture that guys always have to be the one to make the first move. And also this like awful messaging that women have to pretend that they are not sexual beings and they don't enjoy sex. Mm-hmm. And they pretty much have to pretend the whole time that they're just like, oh, well, okay. Like, and there's no like, and you know, God forbid you make the first move, then you are absolutely putting yourself at risk of being slut shamed if you do something like that. So you, and we talk, like I'm talking about what I see in North American culture, but there is no monolithic North American culture. And especially in the dance scene, we're so diverse that you're going to get people with all sorts of different cultural conditioning coming into the scene. So that's something that we have to negotiate constantly within every scene and within North American culture as a whole, how we want to handle this.
Definitely. And you have some questions here for some guys to use in situations where they might be unsure.
Yeah. So there's just a couple of examples. You can totally make up your own questions that you want to ask in the moment. But when things cross over from, you know, dancing to actually being sexually involved with somebody, that's where I think that getting verbal consent becomes much more important. And a lot of people shy away from this if they're not already doing this. They tend to shy away from it because there's this impression that it's going to kind of ruin the moment or make it awkward. But I think it's important to get used to doing this with your partner, whether it's like casual or a serious relationship, because it's the only way really that you can be sure that everybody's okay and comfortable. So first of all, being able to talk to your partner is a really useful test, because if you're trying to talk to somebody and they appear intoxicated, if they're slurring their words, they're not responding to you at all, or their response seems delayed, then you probably should not be sexually involved with that person at all, because they're too intoxicated to consent to any sexual activity. So if you're trying to have a conversation with somebody and they're not able to speak to you, that's a problem. So then if you determine that you believe your partner is competent to engage in sexual activity and they're not intoxicated, then you can ask them questions like, is this okay? Or are you okay? Is it okay if I do whatever thing you're interested in doing? Do you like this thing? So that's kind of a way of asking permission in advance. Or you can do, if you try something and you're not sure about the reaction, you can ask, was that okay? Did you like that? Do you want me to do it again? Like really simple little questions, yes or no answer, and see what they say and evaluate their body language, their tone of voice as you get those responses. And because there are a lot of situations where somebody might not be comfortable saying no. A lot of people are afraid of disappointing their partner or upsetting them. So if you're not sure based on somebody's body language or their tone of voice when they respond to you, ask questions and keep talking to them until you're sure that it's okay to proceed with what's going on.
Definitely. And I think one last point that is really, really important that you said is like, just because consent is given one time, that's not like an all free access pass for the all of eternity, you know?
Yep.
Exactly. It can be withdrawn at any time. If she says stop but has before, then you still have to take that request to stop or that no seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is something that I try to emphasize when I work with health professionals and also when I talk about consent on the dance floor and sexual consent. Just because somebody says yes at the beginning of your relationship, it doesn't give you a blanket yes forever. You never know what's going on with somebody, how they're feeling that day. So, let's use the example of social dancing. Just because a move works great one week with your partner, it doesn't mean that they want to do it every time they social dance with you. It doesn't even mean that they want to social dance with you every single week. Mm-hmm. So it's important to respect that, keep that in mind. Ask for consent before you do something, and respect the no. Like if someone says no to you, absolutely every time stop what you're doing.
Definitely. I think it's a good moment to go ahead and transition into teachers and performers.
Yeah. So when you kind of move up in the dance scene and you start either teaching or performing and being featured as an artist at events, your level of responsibility increases. When you're social dancing, you have a responsibility to your partner in that moment. But once you move into teaching, you accept a whole new level of responsibility. So when you move into teaching, whatever your relationship status is in your personal life, and also whether you have a dance partner or not, you might find that a lot of people are going to start expressing an interest in dancing with you. And more people may express an interest in having a sexual relationship with you as well as your name gets out there. So this kind of introduces the concept of being an authority figure. As soon as your name gets out there and you start to become known, whether you like it or not, you become an authority figure in the dance scene, even if you don't feel like it. And so it's important to understand what that means for you. So we've already kind of talked about how dance teachers are not regulated at all. Mm-hmm. So there's no license. There's no specific professional boundaries. You have to set your own. So there are some teachers, I'm sure, who have like a strict rule that they will never become sexually involved with students or with event attendees if they're being a featured artist at events. And there are lots who are more than happy to do that. So you have to decide what you're comfortable doing and stick to it.
Definitely. And I mean, as a traveling instructor, like, again, this, I feel like it's even more important to play it safe. Your reputation does mean a lot, especially if you're like in the dance scene and the your dance traveling and teaching is like your main source of income. And being sexually involved with someone who's also paying you money is a whole nother dynamic of what's going on, you know? So I think that's really, really important to be aware of as well. Those kind of power dynamics, though they might not be very obvious, are definitely at play, you know?
Yeah. So when you're in that position of being a teacher or performer who travels around, you're right. Like, people are paying money to see you at an event, to learn from you. And your opinion of them as a dancer is going to be very important to them as well. So that's kind of where we have this power imbalance. And if you're choosing to get involved with somebody who is not another artist, they're a student, or even if they're a more junior artist who's less well known, you need to keep your position in mind, because it changes a lot of things in terms of consent. So I just have some questions here that I hope that dancers will consider as their profile starts to increase in a scene. Because I mean, it's really easy when that starts to happen for you to get really excited and caught up in it. And this might be like the furthest thing from your mind, but it can have a huge impact on your career, even without like a very public Me Too style takedown of somebody. It can have major ramifications behind the scenes if people make private complaints about you to event organizers and it gets around, right? So what I would like people to consider is, how will you handle it if a student from your class in your local scene makes a sexual advance towards you? And same thing if it's someone attending an event where you're on staff as a teacher. I don't know if people are always prepared for that, but it happens for sure. So you kind of need to be ready for that and know what your response is going to be and what you're comfortable doing. And then on the flip side of that, if you're just starting out as a teacher or an artist, what are you going to do if a more senior teacher or artist makes sexual advances towards you? Mm-hmm. And what are you going to do if you are attracted to a student who is in your class or who's at an event that you're working? So these are questions that I recommend you think about before you kind of break into the scene, but it's never too late. If you're already an active teacher, these are probably some things you should be considering. Something else that I would like people to consider is, sometimes at events, especially if you're traveling, you may end up at an event where a lot of people don't speak the same language as you. And so it's maybe you have somebody translating for you during your entire class. How are you going to handle it in that situation if you don't speak the same language as somebody who is expressing an interest in you? And so you struggle to communicate verbally in that way. And also, this is kind of where, as you travel around, you're going to have to become much more aware of cultural differences between yourself and people that you're interested in, because you may be running into people who have been raised in a very different way from you and who have very different ideas about consent. So you need to kind of be aware of that and be able to pick up on that quickly in any situation where somebody is expressing an interest in you. The next thing is, are you somebody who in your life as a social dancer likes to drink or use drugs at dance events? And if you are, then you need to consider how that affects your judgment in a situation where someone is expressing an interest in you and whether you want to continue to drink or use drugs when you're working a dance event, or whether you want to decide against that whenever you're on staff to avoid any problems or miscommunications that are more likely to happen when you or the other person are intoxicated.
Definitely.
And then last thing, just to kind of hammer it home, like, how do you handle it if a sexual partner seems uncomfortable or unsure? And what if you suddenly realize that they are visibly under the influence and they suddenly don't seem like they can walk or talk properly?
Yes, all situations to be considered when there's a festival and people are pre-gaming and taking drinks and dancing until 3-4 in the morning and getting on dance highs and other influences. And sometimes it feels like you're like in this different world. You're not a part of reality anymore, being in wherever that venue is. With the festival, it's kind of like its own little ecosystem, and that can kind of create different feelings of what's going on. But it's still very, very important to operate intentionally and responsibly, especially when you are in a position of authority at that event, being just a social dancer, but especially if you are somebody that is hired to provide a service to that event, you know?
Yes. So when you're in that position of power and trust as a teacher, it totally shifts how things, the dynamic between you and the event attendees. People are going to feel like they know you, even if they've never had a conversation with you, because, you know, they've been watching your videos or watching your demos, like where you explain things or demonstrate things. Maybe they've been listening to your podcast. Mm-hmm. So they're going to feel like they know you without ever having met you. So that puts you in a position of power and trust over that person that a regular attendee at an event that they just met and never heard of before would not have. So what this can mean is that a student might agree to things that they don't actually want to do because they don't want to disappoint you. They don't want to upset you or, you know, ruin this chance to have this experience with you. They might be afraid to voice their discomfort with you for the same reason, because they don't want to upset you. You may have access to a lot more sexual partners because of your status and visibility in the community. So you need to consider how you want to handle that. And you may also become the target of more unwanted advances from students or other teachers due to your visibility. So you also have to consider that and how you're going to handle that. If you have a lot of people chasing you around and you're not really into that, that's something that you have to be prepared for as well.
So yes, and this isn't just limited to instructors. It could be event organizers. It could be DJs. It could be instructors. It could be just performers. Like, it could be a dance personality, like just different people. An MC is not necessarily just people who are instructing or teaching, you know?
Right, exactly. So yeah, as soon as you become visible at all in the scene and your name gets out there, this applies to you. And the flip side of this that we're going to get into more when we talk about event organizers, but as soon as you are in that position of trust and power, you may also be put in a situation where somebody comes to you and they confide something in you that happened to them. So they may be coming to you asking for help because, you know, they're being harassed or they've been assaulted. And so you have to be aware of this, you know, even if you are not involved ever with anybody in the scene, and you keep your personal life strictly separate from your professional, you may get pulled into issues with consent in your students' personal lives, and you have to be prepared to handle that as well.
Yes, lots of new challenges and scenarios to now be able to navigate once you get into being visible in that way, you know?
Yes. And then, so if you want to, we can move on to talking about event organizers and what role they need to play in the scene, unless you have more questions for me about teachers.
Nope. Event organizers, it is.
Okay. So this is where you are really in a position of power and trust, and you have to consider, you know, you were talking about like the ecosystem that happens at an individual dance event. So you have to consider what you want the atmosphere to be like at your event and how you want to make sure that people coming to your event have a good experience and that they feel safe. So the first thing when you're organizing an event and you're looking at the artists that you want to hire, you know, when you apply for a job, you're expected to give references and like a criminal record check. The same sort of applies when you're hiring artists for your event, but it's a much more informal structure. So you can definitely ask for references from other event organizers. But what you want to do is just get a sense of their reputation in their home community and also from other organizers who have hired them. So if you're, you know, hiring somebody who hasn't traveled a lot, it can be more difficult, but it's still good to just ask around because people talk. So chances are, even if you aren't able to speak with someone directly who has had a problem with somebody, you will hear about it if somebody has behaved inappropriately in the past. So I really recommend making contacts in the scene that the person comes from and trying to figure out what their behavior has been like so that you know you're hiring somebody who's going to be safe for your attendees.
Definitely. And I think having that in place where attendees are able to have an outlet where they can go to with those kind of things versus feeling like they're kind of stuck with that and they don't have somewhere to go or someone to talk to, I feel like it's really, really nice.
Yeah. I mean, as an event organizer, whether you make yourself open and available to people or not, whether you like it or not, you are that person. So people are going to come to you if they have issues. Because some people, you know, some people will be very shy and afraid to come forward, but there are lots of people who are not. So if there's somebody who is causing trouble at your event, you are going to have to be prepared to deal with that. So the next thing that I want to say, like it deals with event organizers, but it applies to everybody in the scene in some degree. So if somebody comes to you with a complaint about somebody that you've hired for an event, here are some things that you want to consider and remember when you're talking to this person. So the first thing is to take their complaint seriously. You never want to dismiss a complaint immediately or reflexively. That can be really hurtful for the person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody knows if you're an event organizer and you're in the middle of an event, it is a super stressful time. But even if you can't make the time to speak with somebody immediately about something that's going on, make sure that you show them that you care about what they have to say and make time to speak with them privately later about whatever's going on. It's really important to show that you take this seriously and not be dismissive. The next thing would be just to listen to what the person has to say. Don't be formulating a response in your head as the person's talking. Just listen, take note of what they're saying, try to absorb it, and then once they're done telling you their story, you can take it from there. Another thing that's important is to ask the person who's complaining to you what they would like to see happen as a result of their complaint, because not everybody is going to want the same thing. In some cases, there may be someone, this is relatively rare, but that you may be faced with somebody who wants to go to the police and formal police report as a result of what happened. Hopefully this would be a very rare circumstance, but if it does happen, you need to make sure that you know what the rights are for a victim of sexual assault in your city. If you're not aware and you're an event organizer, I recommend brushing up on it. Maybe have a document that explains it with you at the event, at the venue, just in case anything happens, so that you can give this person correct information, because this is going to be a very stressful time for both of you. Some people may want you to mediate between them and the perpetrator. So they may want you to go talk to the perpetrator and try to help them work out the situation, because they don't feel comfortable doing it by themselves. You know, but chances are they're not going to feel safe around this person anymore. But they don't want to go to the police either, because that's also extremely stressful. So you need to consider if you are prepared to help in that situation, or if you really don't feel comfortable, then it would be best to figure out if there's somebody else on your staff who feels comfortable in mediating in a situation like this, and you need to discuss that with them.
Definitely.
Also, in some cases, the person who's making the complaint may not feel comfortable having the perpetrator around at the event anymore. So I would recommend having a policy in place in case the victim doesn't want to press charges and they don't want to participate in mediation, and they're stating that they don't feel safe with that person in the event anymore. You need to have some sort of policy in place for removing somebody from the event in case a situation like this comes up. And lastly, you may have a lot of situations where somebody just wants to make you aware of problematic behavior, and they don't want any action taken on your part. They don't want the perpetrator to know that they made a complaint. They're just telling you and handing that information to you. You also need to figure out how you're going to deal with that.
Also very important. So I know it's not the most comfortable thing to think about what happens when things go wrong like this at the event. But I think it's just like preparation from the event organizer standpoint. If this happens, then this is how we're going to respond. You know, I feel like the situation can definitely escalate unfavorably if you don't have kind of like rules set on how you're going to handle certain situations, even though they may come up. You're not hoping for these things to happen, but it's kind of like having an insurance plan of just in case something happens, this is something that you can use to your advantage, you know?
Yeah. So something that I'm seeing in the Zouk scene is some festivals that post like a consent policy publicly, like it's posted at the registration desk when you walk in. So whatever policy the event organizers come up with, it's good to have it there publicly so that you can refer back to it in a situation where you either have to mediate or remove somebody from your event. I think that's a good thing to draft just as a routine part of organizing an event.
Definitely. And I'm not sure if there's any templates out there that maybe we can find and maybe include that in the show notes, but we'll try to find something that could be nice that I've seen at other events that could be used as a template.
Yeah, I believe the first one that I saw, I think, was the Hawaii Zouk Festival. They had like a really clear one that was posted. So that will probably be floating around on Facebook. But this is such a new territory that I don't think there are really any templates out there just yet.
Awesome. So that we just covered expectations and insights from dancers, social dancers and students, from teachers and performers or artists or any high profile member where there could be seen some kind of authority or popularity. And we also cover what it means as being an event organizer, from just like a weekender to a workshop to a festival. And one thing that I really, really liked here in the document that you had prepared for the podcast was just a couple of myths to go over and just let people know how sometimes they may be taught to believe something else that is actually a myth, especially when it comes to terms of consent.
Yeah. So there are a couple things that I think are persistent cultural myths, and I hope that they kind of, you know, go away as time goes on and as we continue to have this conversation as a culture. So I just want to run through a couple of them really quickly. So the first one is consent is not something that is only given by women to men. That is such a persistent myth. And I understand why this conversation about consent has been framed around, mostly around, you know, heterosexual couples and women being the ones who have to give consent for sexual activity to men. Mm-hmm. Because right now, it is a lot of the really high profile cases have been women who have had their boundaries violated and they're not putting up with it anymore. So, and I mean, that's bound to be the case in a culture where the men are expected to make the first move all the time. But we all have boundaries. And at some point in our lives, most of us are going to run into situations where those boundaries get crossed. So it doesn't matter what your gender is, if you feel uncomfortable or upset about any situation that involves touch, you know, I recommend reaching out to a trusted friend or your dance teacher, if you find them to be trustworthy, to talk about the situation, just so that you get that validation of knowing that your discomfort is real and important, and that you deserve to feel comfortable in every situation. So that's why I've tried to talk about consent so far using gender neutral language, because this can be a problem for anybody. So next up, I just want to emphasize quickly that false reporting of sexual assault is extremely rare. So I have had conversations with a lot of my male friends who have been concerned about being falsely accused of sexual assault or having their dance career ruined because somebody falsely accuses them of harassment or assault. You know, reporting something like this, even if you're friends with your dance teacher and that's the only person you report it to, it is really stressful to report assault or harassment. So you would have to be a pretty sick person to make it up and use that to destroy somebody. It does happen, unfortunately. There are absolutely bad people out there who would do something like that, but it's really, really rare. The statistics on this are extremely shaky because reporting is so rare in the first place. So, you know, I've heard multiple numbers about this. I believe the last number I heard was 2% of sexual assault reports that are actually made to the police turn out to be false. But if you contrast that with the actual number of sexual assaults that happen, I'm sure that the number would fall to much lower than 2% because reporting is so incredibly rare. So yeah, that's something I really wanted to emphasize. And then I just, going back to the Me Too movement and this fear of being very like publicly shamed and taken down for a sexual assault allegation, I want to emphasize that that is not all that the movement is about. It is much more about supporting survivors of sexual assault and showing how common a problem it is in society and just raising general awareness. So it's much more about this conversation instead of a hit job on men. There are a lot of powerful men and a couple of powerful women who have experienced this fall from grace very publicly because a large number of accusers have come forward. But often that is because those accusers are aware that they're not going to get anything done without public pressure because that person is so powerful. So if you are just a regular person and you're a regular social dancer, you don't really have anything to worry about because a lot of victims, in my experience, prefer to handle these things privately because handling it publicly is so, so stressful. So I just want to emphasize that. So I was just going to say, if, you know, since it will be handled privately, if you do have, you know, if you make a mistake, if you do something that hurts somebody as a result of a misunderstanding or you failing to read signs or failing to listen, chances are what is actually going to happen is a confrontation with that person or some sort of warning or confrontation with a leader in the scene. If that happens to you, just try to learn from it and move on. But again, I don't think you have to worry about a very public blow up. That's not really what I've seen happen so far.
Definitely. I was just looking at the document and we talked about how widespread it all seems. And then I think just also like not falling into the stereotype that all victims are women and not all of the people doing this are men, you know?
Yeah. So I have heard from a lot of people who's and like seeing this on social media and in personal conversations, there are a lot of people, and especially men, who seem to struggle to accept that this problem is as widespread as women are saying it is. And they also struggle to accept the fact that they could be capable of this, or that some of their friends might be capable of these like severe boundary violations. So to those people, I mean, if you have never had to think about this until now, consider yourself fortunate. There is a huge segment of the population that has to think about this every day. And before the Me Too movement came up, like I had some kind of heated conversations with men in my life about this, where I was kind of saying like, you know, most women think about this all the time. And I'm sure there are a lot of male survivors out there who think about this all the time and don't even have anybody to talk about it with. But there are a lot of people who think about this, who think about the risk of being assaulted all the time. And I was kind of like emphasizing, like, yes, like you can ask any woman out there pretty much, and they will say that this is something that crosses their mind whenever they meet somebody new, whenever they're alone with someone. So even if it's uncomfortable and shocking for you, I get it. But it is unfortunately statistically likely that you know somebody who has committed sexual assault, because most assaults are carried out by someone known to the victim. So this myth that like all assaults are committed by somebody hiding in the bushes, it's not really true at all. So if, you know, if you're not sure if this is true, if you're having trouble with this whole conversation, the best thing to do is just listen carefully when stories are shared with you, and try not to get defensive and center yourself in the situation and say that I'm a good person. Just try to listen to what they have to say. And if you do decide to ask questions, be respectful when you ask those questions, and don't attack the person telling their story. And I do just want to stress one more time that not all victims of sexual assault are women, and not all assailants are men. Anybody can be a victim, and anybody can be a perpetrator.
For sure. Definitely. So this has been very, very, very insightful. And I'm sure this is like just a well-needed conversation. And the podcast, I feel, is a really good platform to kind of put this information out there, just to get people thinking and talking in terms of these things as well, you know. And I think with at the end of the document here, you have some nice definitions of some terms that get thrown around a lot. And sometimes people might not know exactly what they mean or how they're defined. And I think you did a really good job of kind of breaking that down for these kind of key terms when this kind of topic comes into conversation.
Yeah. So these are not the things that I wrote down here. They're not dictionary definitions or anything. This is just some topics that I think intersect with this conversation that we're having about consent as a culture. So I don't think we mentioned it before, but by training, I'm an anthropologist. So I'm just kind of looking at this moment in our culture. And I think it's important to emphasize that no culture is ever static, like it never stays the same forever. And there's no one like natural way to be human. We negotiate everything in our culture. So anything is up for change at any time. There's no like cultural institution that stays the same forever. So there's a bunch of other kind of side conversations that are taking place at the same time as this conversation about consent. So big one, and one that is really controversial and a lot of people don't like it, is talking about this idea of toxic masculinity. I think part of the pushback to this is because the name sounds so bad and it makes a lot of guys feel like they're being attacked, but it is not saying, and I can't stress this enough, it is not saying that to be masculine is to be bad. There's nothing wrong with being a man. It's saying that the way that we raise our boys in our culture causes them a lot of problems. And so in relation to consent, where toxic masculinity comes into that is this idea that we've talked about already, where men have to make the first move in the relationship. That's your responsibility as a guy. You have to make the first move, you have to move the relationship along, not just in terms of sex, but in terms of like the other norms that we see where like it has to be the man who proposes marriage to a woman and things like that. Mm-hmm. So that puts so much pressure on men, and it requires you to have like this almost human ability to read social cues and body language, which is hilariously enough not something that we really encourage in boys, is being sensitive to social cues and body language and things like that. So that's a problem. And there's also, of course, it's encouraged or expected that men will be the dominant partner in the relationship for the length of the relationship. So that puts a lot of pressure on men. And if they end up in a situation where that doesn't happen, it can cause a negative reaction, no matter how much they like the person. And then obviously for LGBTQ people, this makes no sense at all. We really need to come up with a better way of handling, initiating relationships and negotiating power in relationships. Kind of going off the toxic masculinity thing, there's also big conversation happening right now about vulnerability. And so I just kind of view that in this context as openly discussing our needs and our desires with our partner. This is something that is not encouraged in men at all. It's not really encouraged at all in our culture, but it's really not encouraged for men to do something like this. And so I encourage everybody to explore that a little bit. Look at where you're not comfortable being open about what you want, whether it's with sex or with something totally unrelated, because I think that it's a really good thing to be able to be upfront about what you're looking for in life. And there are a ton of resources on YouTube and all over the internet to deal with vulnerability.
Yeah, I'll share some videos by Brené Brown. She has some pretty good stuff as on there. So I'll include one of her popular videos in the show notes so people can check that out.
Yeah, yep. She's like the number one person for that at the moment. So another conversation that kind of comes into all of this is, of course, feminism and living in a patriarchal society. Where this kind of affects consent is it's kind of the flip side of toxic masculinity, where women are conditioned to believe that it's wrong or shameful for them to enthusiastically consent to sex, let alone initiate a sexual relationship. So then that's where you get a lot of this double speak that we're used to in our culture right now, where women are taught that, you know, they have to say no the first time and, you know, walk away, but then you're looking over your shoulder expecting the guy to chase after you because that's his job. It's ridiculous. I'm kind of glad that we're working towards discarding it as a culture and just being able to say, like, I like you, regardless of your gender or the gender of the person that you are into. So, and, you know, slut shaming kind of comes into all of that as well, where if you are open about, you know, your sexual past or your preferences as a woman, you can expect to get some pushback on that. So that's something I think is going to change as well.
For sure.
And then another big one that makes a lot of people angry is talking about rape culture. So I just have a really simple definition for that. It's just a culture where we tend to, our reflex tends to be blaming people for their own assault. So most people are pretty familiar with this. It's the whole, like, what are you wearing? What were you doing alone with him? Were you drinking? Et cetera, et cetera. And there's a big conversation going on in our culture around that right now, and a lot of pushback to it. And, it's definitely still a problem where you scrutinize the victim instead of scrutinizing the assailant for their behavior. But I'm hoping that that's something we're going to see change a lot in the next decade or so.
I agree. And we have one last one here.
Yeah. So this one is a little more positive. So something that I think is important when we're having a conversation about something this sensitive and something that's so difficult for people to share their experiences is the idea of active listening. So all that means is you're listening to show the person that you understand and that you empathize instead of listening to respond. So I think a lot of us are probably guilty of this where, you know, somebody is telling us something and maybe it doesn't quite make sense to us. It doesn't fit with our worldview. And instead of, you know, just being quiet, listening, and trying really hard to put ourselves in their position, we listen. And as the person is talking, we formulate a response based on our own experience to throw back at them as soon as they're done talking. Mm-hmm. And that is not terribly productive. If you are having a conversation with somebody about this and they're saying things that really don't make sense to you, I encourage you to just listen, turn off that reflex to respond. And then when they're done talking, then you can think about formulating some thoughtful questions so that you try to understand instead of just getting defensive immediately. I think if more people are able to do that, it will help us have more productive conversations. And again, I'm sure this idea has been around for a long time. So if you Google it, there are loads of resources out there.
For sure. And I think you gave us some links as well that we can add to the show notes as well if you guys are more interested in this. Yeah. And I think as we get close to the end of the podcast here, you said that this one is a little bit more positive. So I get that some of us might feel uncomfortable, even myself included, talking about these things because sometimes it's just hard to believe that it's so out there and it's like these things are really happening, how often it's happening, you know? And it can seem a little bit overwhelming sometimes, or like there's like sometimes a feeling of disbelief that this amount of breaches of consent and sexual assaults and all these kind of things are happening out there. But even though it's an uncomfortable conversation to some people, I feel like it's really, really important to start to have it. And I think, as you mentioned before, being more in touch with our feelings and being vulnerable to share things that we want and not putting burden or stress on one particular party to like make a move or have this expectation of playing hard to get or anything like that. These seem to be more antiquated ways of interacting. And now we're seeing kind of like the results of that as a society. So as we start to have more of these conversations and we kind of break these quote unquote norms of what things are supposed to happen, we can kind of step into the light of more consent, more openness, and more, I guess, healthy relationships across the board.
Yes, absolutely. It is definitely a hard thing to talk about, especially for the first time, and especially if you were kind of unaware of this until now. It can be a really touchy subject. I definitely hope that anybody in the Toronto scene or anybody at Canada Zoo Congress would feel comfortable approaching me about it. My friend Laura Riva is also a great person to talk to. She is super calm under pressure. So if you find that you really don't have anybody to talk to about this in your own community, you know, message us, or if you are in Toronto, approach us. I hope she doesn't mind me speaking for her, but I've just seen her interact with a lot of people online and she is awesome and super calm about everything. So I kind of like the last thing that I want to mention about this, or a prediction that I want to make, is talking about like where this is going to go from here. Because right now the focus has been on raising awareness that this is even a problem and emphasizing that it's a real issue and it is extremely widespread. So I think the next kind of step is going to be talking about how we want to handle this in the future. So how we want to teach our children about consent, but also what we want to do when assaults are reported in the future, because I don't think that going through the justice system all the time is going to be the answer. I don't think that putting all of the assailants in jail is going to help at all. I mean, mass incarceration, I don't think is ever the answer to any sort of social ill. So I think that we're going to see a lot more discussion about how to mediate or have some sort of restorative justice process between assailants and victims? And also, how do we tell when somebody who is definitely guilty of something like this, how do we tell when they're rehabilitated? What do they have to do to show us that they have fixed the issue, that they're rehabilitated and ready to be a normal part of society again, so that they're not ostracized forever? Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of the cases in everyday life kind of look like the situation that a lot of people saw with the comedian Aziz Ansari, mm-hmm. Where it was an encounter that started out consensual, but the woman in the situation felt really uncomfortable, and she tried to convey that non-verbally, but he didn't get it, and then she was left feeling really violated, and then she eventually made her allegations public, and he was kind of ostracized for a while because of it, and now he's trying to make this career come back. I think that is, like, a lot of this exists in this real, like, gray area where it's not necessarily illegal anyways, but it's still hurtful. So I think that's kind of going to be the next step as a culture, is determining what we do with people like that, who are not, you know, terrible people to the core. They made a big mistake and an error in judgment, and they need to, there should be consequences for that, but what those consequences are going to look like, and how we're going to handle them going forward.
For sure. I think it's going to be really, really important to see how it all unfolds. And like, this change in the dance scene is going kind of in tandem with what our society is kind of going through as a whole, you know? So our dance scenes kind of act as a microcosm of what's going on in actual society. And that's like a global society, not just something that's limited to a particular country or city.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right, Caitlin, thank you so much for taking your time out of your day to kind of share this important conversation with us. And I'm really excited that we're able to use the podcast platform to kind of talk about this, to kind of help spread awareness, which is kind of the current step that we're in right now, to kind of give forth and pave the way to kind of a healthier dance scene overall, which is also going to help us as people to just make everyday society more safe and healthier for everybody, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And the last thing that I will get you to add to the page for the podcast is just some resources in the US and Canada for anybody who has experienced sexual assault and might feel deeply affected by this podcast and by listening to this or considering this problem. So I'll provide you with some resources that people can either reach out to by phone or email or text if they feel like they really need to talk to somebody about this.
All right, Caitlin, thank you so much for your time. Thank you, audience, tuning in and listening. And if you have any comments or feedback or something that you'd like us to discuss or any ideas, feel free to hit us up on Facebook and we'll be listening, and we'll see you guys in the next episode. Thank you so much, Caitlin.
Thank you.
Thank you for checking out the Dance Your Heart on Fire podcast today. Be sure to check out neokizomba.com for links to everything that we chatted about today, as well as some awesome free resources to enhance your Kizomba journey. Don't call me when there's no one else. Don't call me.